From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Scientific discoveries can help explain our world and offer solutions to the problems we face as a species. But there's a problem. Science is complicated, it's technical, and there's one thing scientists aren't very good at: telling stories. That's according to scientist-turned-filmmaker Randy Olson. Olson says there's a growing disconnect between what scientists know and what the general public understands, pointing to the continuing debate over global warming and evolution to make his case. And he argues that knowledge gap stems from the inability of many scientists to communicate. Today on the program, Randy Olson joins us to talk about why storytelling matters. Plus, the evolution of Utah cuisine, courtesy of the Junior League. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. No question, science involves a lot of data and technical jargon and Latin. Still, that same science can help us understand the natural world, prevent disease, lead to groundbreaking technologies, and solve real problems. But Randy Olson says that message isn't resonating with the general public, and scientists, to a large extent, are to blame. Joining me now to talk about why scientists need to brush up on their storytelling skills, Randy Olson. He is an award-winning filmmaker and author. He has a PhD from Harvard and was a tenured professor at the University of New Hampshire when he decided to leave academia for filmmaking. And he's produced two full-length films, Flock of Dodos and Sizzle, a series of short films, and he's co-founder of the group Shifting Baselines, an ocean media project. His book, Don't Be Such a Scientist, is a guidebook for scientists to become more effective storytellers. And Randy Olson joins us from NPR West in Culver City, California. And Randy, thanks so much for your time today.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Olson will present Storytelling, Clear Proof Scientists Descended from Humans, Thursday, that's tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, at the City Library, 210 East 4th South in Salt Lake City. Olson is the first speaker in the Natural History Museum of Utah's annual Nature of Things lecture series, and you can hear it live here on KCPW. The event is free and open to the public. Later on in the program, the Junior League of Salt Lake City on trends in taste. But first, storytelling and science. Do you read, watch, or listen to scientific theories or discoveries? What would make science more relevant to you in your life? 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Randy Olson, you began your career studying coral reefs. You earned a PhD from Harvard. You were a tenured marine biologist. Why give it all up to move to Hollywood?
People ask me that all the time. They say it must have been a giant transition. But to me, the unifying theme of both careers is storytelling. And I don't see it as all that big of a change. I think what drew me into the world of science was some senior scientists that I met early on who were just tremendous storytellers. And I sat there enraptured as they told stories of the natural world and their experiences. And science and filmmaking really are the same basic process. With science, you go out into the real world, you gather data, you come back into a lab, you put the data together eventually into a story that you tell the world via either a public talk or a written paper. Filmmaking is the same thing. You go out into the world, you shoot some film, you come back into the editing suite, you edit it all together, and you share it with the world as a story. So I see them as very similar.
But one of your early mentors, I understand, was Stephen Jay Gould, who excelled at storytelling and the ability to relay very complicated information to a lay audience. What were some of the tips that he gave to you? What kind of effect did he have, his storytelling method and his research, have on your life as a filmmaker today?
Oh, he didn't even know who I was. I was an insect in, in his world, basically. And he was arrogant and obnoxious to me. But that said, I was the number one fan. And he truly is, in my opinion, about the greatest science communicator ever, in large part because he was so well-versed in the humanities. And I think that is the answer, and that's the problem with the science world today, is that it's kind of worked its way so far off from the humanities that you're ending up with this whole new breed of scientists that simply can't speak in normal kind of storytelling terms and can't relate with so much of the broader common parts of our culture. Gould was great with that in that he was just so well-versed in all these different areas of everything from architecture to art to opera. And he could draw on examples from those realms and use them in this basic principle that I present at the beginning of my book that I got from communications professors. The idea of arouse and fulfill, that reaching the broad audience is as simple as two things. First, you need to arouse the interest of the people that you're talking to. And then once they're interested, you need to fulfill their expectations of what you've gotten them interested in. And that first part is the hard part. How are you going to arouse people's interest? And the way you do that, in large part, is by reaching into things that they can relate with, and that's quite often from the humanities. And every one of Gould's essays that he wrote every month in the Natural History magazine column that he had for 25 years, almost every single one of them just followed that formula perfectly. They began with two or three paragraphs of arousal that would be something from the world of baseball or Mickey Mouse or who knows what. And then he would segue from that very logically and organically into the piece of science that he wanted to try and convey to you.
When did this kind of hit you over the head, that there was a disconnect, a knowledge gap in, you know, what scientists are doing and what these discoveries actually mean for the rest of us?
I think the hitting over the head began slowly and seems to be getting worse over the years. It's becoming torture nowadays. Just recently was invited to give a keynote address at a meeting of 1,000 scientists about 3 weeks ago, and there were four of these keynote addresses. The first three were from other scientists, and I just sat there in disbelief, listening to these presentations that were so bad. I mean, they were, and what hit me was, I've been following the science world for 35 years now, and in those 35 years of going to science talks, the technology has changed drastically. Back 35 years ago, scientists would stand up there and use overhead projector with handwritten overheads, and that was the norm. Today, you'd get laughed out of the auditorium if you showed up with handwritten overheads. You know, it's all PowerPoint and everything like that. So the technology's changed so much, and yet the information structure that they use hasn't changed one bit. They give the same disorganized, rambling, unfocused mess of a presentation today that they did 35 years ago, and there's no standards. Nobody cares. It's this bizarre, almost emperor has no clothes behavior they engage in. They all sit there at these giant meetings, listen to these horrible presentations, and nobody complains. And at that particular event, at the reception afterwards, all these people came up to me and said, "You need to give a copy of your book to all three of those speakers. Don't be such a scientist." It's really sad.
I want to play a clip from one of your films, Flock of Dodos, that speaks directly to this point. I'm going to play it, and then I'll get you to to embellish after. This is from Flock of Dodos by Randy Olson.
People who are scientists who study evolution feel there is no controversy that it's been manufactured by those who would
scientists
like to see evolution.
Scientists and professors
a lot of science
discredited. Are some of the worst communicators I know. They understand things like way up here, we're like way down here, and they can't even get halfway.
A lot of science discredited in the public's mind, but in reality there's no controversy.
But in simple terms, what...
Teach the science.
Is that something you've heard people saying?
No. But I would say teach the science.
Is there any phrase, catchphrase for the evolutionists that you've heard propagated?
No. Have you?
No.
Randy Olson, that clip, of course, talking about how there's no real catchy way to explain evolution, or at least, you know, it hasn't been marketed or branded or run through the spin cycle. Is that part of the problem?
Yeah, first off, that was Dave Botcher from USC, actually, a paleontology professor. There was such a good sport to take part in my movie and let me have fun with him like that. And then that was Sue Gamble from the Kansas School Board offering her commentary about the inability of scientists to communicate. And yeah, it's an infinite problem. They're kind of so deeply buried in their world of information and minutiae and detail, it's hard for them to really connect with what the broader public is able to kind of just grasp in terms of these concepts. And that was one particular example where the people attacking the field of evolution had come up with a very catchy slogan called Teach the Controversy. And I was asking him, has the science world come up with anything equal? And he said, nope. And that's kind of how it goes with a lot of these things.
Why is that? Why do you think that there's been this ignorance on the part of scientists to communicate effectively?
they don't value communication. They see it as really frivolous and largely a waste of time and energy. You see this tremendously when you go to the business world that values communication. They know, you know, you have to spend all this money on advertising, and they just don't even question it. But more importantly, since the publication of my book in 2009, I've begun to see it through working with the public health sector. And never occurred to me that my book would end up playing to that field, but they are the folks that instantly got it. And so I've been doing workshops at places like the Centers for Disease Control and the National Institute of Health and with groups of doctors. And those folks are down at the level of the public. Their field is called public health. They've already got it in the name of what it is that they do. They don't spend any time questioning whether or not they should waste any energy connecting with the public. They know that if they don't connect 100% with the public, then everything they've done is going to be useless. That doesn't happen with the science crowd. They tend to, after World War II, we created all these scientific research institutes and this whole new species of scientists, basically, that is not accountable to the public. They just get their dollars from the government, and they sit there doing their work. And it's very good in some regards that they're able to be so specialized, but there's a price to it eventually. In the end, you still have to kind of account to the public as what you're doing with their money.
Randy Olson, he is an independent filmmaker, the author of the book Don't Be Such a Scientist. He's presenting the lecture Storytelling, Clear Proof Scientists Descended from Humans tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the City Library as part of the Nature of Things lecture series sponsored by the Natural History Museum of Utah. And you can hear it live here on KCPW. If you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number. Scientists, do you admit that Randy Olson has a point when it comes to storytelling? 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Randy Olson, so what does effective storytelling mean to you?
It's very simple. Storytelling has three basic parts. It's about, number one, grabbing the interest of an audience. Number two, holding their interest as you lead them on a journey. And then number three, paying off their interest in a satisfying manner as you answer the questions that you've posed early on to grab their attention with. And why those three basic elements are not taught as the very first lesson in science is something I'm trying to get some answers on. And it has to do with the science world just not valuing communication. Furthermore, there is what I call story phobia, which is the irrational dread fear of the word story and storytelling. And that's what happens with scientists. When I published my book in 2009, the one review that was written in The New Scientist, the reviewer accused me of advocating, quote, bending the science to tell better stories. And I ended up having to send a letter to the editor that they published in which I said, I'm sorry, but on page 111 of my book, I say verbatim, I would never support anything short of 100% accuracy in the communication of science. And setting the record straight, and that's just their phobia coming to the surface, that they are afraid that if you start thinking about how to communicate effectively, you'll start lying. And that just isn't true. You know, there's so many great journalists that communicate nonfiction information day in and day out, and they know the importance of structuring their information according to these basic rules of storytelling to grab interest, hold it, and pay it off.
We're speaking with Randy Olson, the scientist turned filmmaker behind such films as Flock of Dodos and Sizzle. He's joining us tomorrow night for the Nature of Things lecture. And let's go to the phones. Brian is joining us from Salt Lake City. Brian, hi.
Hi. So, hi, Jennifer.
Hi. Go right ahead.
So, I am also a scientist. I am here in Utah doing my postdoctoral research, and I was calling because I mostly disagree with what's being shared. I feel like I've been to maybe a dozen scientific conferences, and I feel like as a whole that most of the talks that I've seen have been rather good, and that the scientists I've seen have been really good communicators, and I do agree that we don't interact with the public maybe as much as we should, but I think that as a whole, if we were given the opportunity, I think a lot of the communication skills are actually quite good. So anyway, I just wanted to share that opinion.
Would you say, Brian, that the conferences that you've attended do tend to be sort of inside baseball, a little dry, maybe not as colloquial as you might in a public lecture setting?
Yes, I definitely agree that they're pretty technical, but if you have, I'd say a moderate degree or even in some conferences a minimal education in some basic science terms, you know, you'd be able to follow a lot of it. I feel like a lot of talks have, you know, pretty good introductions that people who aren't specialists can still follow. And so, I mean, some conferences, they are specialized, and so you have to have a lot of knowledge, and some definitely for a more general science crowd. And so I think, that the talks in general have always been really good, and I feel like most of the professors I've had have been really great at being able to communicate to undergraduates and, you know, to a more general crowd. Maybe not a general crowd without a little bit of background, but still, I don't know. I feel like the quality of communication skills is a really prized asset. We have to be able to communicate with each other, so I feel like we do spend a lot of time training ourselves.
Okay, Brian, thanks very much for those thoughts. 801-355-8255 is the number. Randy Olson, want to get your response. Tough crowd out there. Is there some defensiveness among the scientific community to what you're saying?
This is what I run up against. First off, I'm talking about broad communication, and make that clear from the outset. We're talking about, you said at the beginning, these issues of climate change and evolution and trying to get the public to connect with this. So I'm not talking about scientific meetings, exactly what you pointed out. You go back to that simple principle of arouse and fulfill. An audience member like Brian there, he's already pre-aroused when he goes to a science meeting. He's already interested in the subject matter. He will sit there, as I say, this basic ethic of listening and being polite and letting these people say their stuff. But that's very different from the general public who aren't pre-aroused, and you got to get their interest somehow, some way, and that's where the science crowd falls down in doing that. And one of the complications is that one of the things I present in the book is this divide between cerebral versus visceral orientations. And the more cerebral you get, the more heavily educated you get, the more locked in and more narrow you become, and the more difficult it is for you to listen. The best review written of my book when it came out was in Science Magazine. And the reviewer said, nice book, but it missed the biggest shortcoming of scientists, which is their inability to listen. And the more I've worked with this stuff, it's just, I'm kind of getting the end of my wits at times. They do not listen. They don't know how to listen. They don't train themselves to listen. Actors know how to listen. That's what they're trained to do. That's the way you become a good actor, is listening and incorporating everything that's going on around you into a performance. Scientists are taught to lecture and to be kind of rigid and focused in what they do. So it's really hard for me when I try and talk with a lot of these scientists and explain these things to them. It's just a brick wall. And that's why I say, it's a different dynamic when I go to the public health world. They're already trained a little bit to listen because they know they have to connect with the public. And a lot of these science institutions bring me in, and because I have a PhD, they throw me like a lion tamer. They throw me in a room full of scientists and say, here, we can't do anything with these guys. Why don't you try and talk to them? And it's very bad. I was at a major place 2 years ago, like 5,000 employees, the science institution. I won't say the name, but at the end of my day there, the last meeting that we had was with 8 of their communicators, and it was basically a support group for victims of scientist abuse. And we went around the room as each of them told their stories of how scientists have gone off on them. And the last one was a woman who started crying, telling about a story she did, interviewed a scientist. He went through 15 different projects. She wrote her article about 3 of his projects, and he called her up and was shouting at her, saying, I told you about all these different things I'm doing, and the only thing you put in your article was these 3 things. Well, that's because you don't understand. This is how broad communication works. You can't put all 15 things in there. So that's the kind of stuff you deal with.
We're talking about the art of science and why storytelling matters with Randy Olson. He is an award-winning filmmaker and author, a marine biologist in training, and author of the book Don't Be Such a Scientist. He's coming to Salt Lake City tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. He'll be delivering the Nature of Things lecture, Storytelling, Clear Proof Scientists Descended from Humans, at the City Library, and you can hear it live here on KCPW. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW in Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Today on the program, we're talking about making science relevant and understandable to the rest of us non-science types with scientist turned independent filmmaker Randy Olson. Olson says if there's a weak link in science today, it's the failure to translate complex scientific discoveries to the general audience. He is the author of the book, Don't Be Such a Scientist. He's coming to Salt Lake City tomorrow to deliver the lecture, Storytelling, Clear Proof Scientists Descended from Humans, at 7 o'clock at the City Library. There's more information on our website, kcpw.org. If you have questions or comments about scientists and storytelling, give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Randy Olson, the title of your book, Don't Be Such a Scientist. It's kind of snide. I want to talk about the role that humor plays in your take on storytelling and why we should be able to laugh at ourselves and poke a little fun.
In a perfect world, that would be nice. Yeah, it's really sad sometimes when you get people who are so humorless. At the core of my book, in the very beginning, is this principle that I learned in acting class. So, you know, my story was I was 38 years old when I walked away from my tenured professorship, moved out here to LA, and entered into not only film school, but more importantly, a two-year acting program. And it was in that acting class that this horrible acting teacher confronted me the first night, screaming her lungs out at me. And the things that she said over the course of the next 2 years took me 10 years to really percolate through my calcified, rigidified brain that I had as a scientist. And eventually began to kind of make sense as I came back around to working with the academic world. And of all the different things she said, the simplest of all principles was she would say that acting, which by the way, acting and communication are not just similar, they are one and the same, they're identical. It's not a coincidence that the president that came to be known as the great communicator, Ronald Reagan, was himself an actor. And so she would say, in trying to connect with the broad audience, you have four organs in your body that are important: your head, your heart, your gut, and the sex organs, this vertical axis going from the top down. The object of acting and communicating to try and reach that broad audience is to come out of your head into your heart with some emotion, into your gut with some humor, and all the way down to the sex organs occasionally with some sex appeal. And those are the visceral elements, those three that are below the neckline. And that's how you reach the broader audience, is by being a little more visceral like that. But it's so counter to the heavily cerebral world of scientists, and that's the challenge that they face.
Mm. I want to play another clip from your film, Flock of Dodos. This is a Harvard professor, Jim Handon, and he's explaining what he sees as unintelligent design of a rabbit's digestive tract. Let's take a listen, and we'll get your response. Hang on.
Rabbits have a truly, what we from a human vantage point, a truly disgusting design of their gut. Same thing, they eat plant matter, they chew it up as much as they can in their mouth, pass the food down, past the stomach, past the small intestine, past the large intestine, into the cecum, which is a chamber way, way in the back. That's their fermentation chamber. The problem is this is now past the absorptive site in the gut. They then excrete through the anus these little pellets. They're called cecotrophs because they're produced in the cecum. It's not feces, but they excrete them. They turn around, eat them, process them again, and pass them now by the small intestine where the nutrients are assimilated into the bloodstream. Where is the intelligent design in that?
That's Harvard professor Jim Handon explaining the rabbit's digestive system. And I guess my question for you is, if you could see this, listeners, it's an animation. Clearly, there's some sound effects going on there. Randy Olson, how does animation, how does music, how do sound effects really make science a lot more accessible?
Well, the first thing I'll say is that was from my movie Flock of Dodos, which we had a tremendous screening, I think, in 2007 there in Salt Lake City at the Salt Lake Film Center. It's a beautiful facility of that movie. And so I'm really excited coming back to town. And, yeah, you know, again, that's how you broaden things out. It's the real divide is between the literal versus the non-literal. So literal means just the pure information with no noise associated, and that's what you want in the science world. And that caller who called earlier, you know, that was really one of the best calls I've gotten in a long time. We could spend an entire hour dissecting the things that he said in that call. But part of what he's saying is that he enjoys going to a meeting and listening to these great presentations because they are so pure in their information content. They're not filled with a whole bunch of crazy entertainment and celebrities and everything else like that. And that's the language, that's the clinical language of science. It's very literal, which is wonderful. But the public doesn't communicate that way, and that's too dry for them. And so you've got to spice things up a little bit with the more non-literal elements, and that's where humor and emotion and occasionally even sexual content come into play. They all add humor to the package, and that's what people like. They like their messaging a little more indirect and have some fun with it, and that's where the humor comes into play. That was the difference between my movie ending up on some dry television channel versus ending up being on Showtime for 2 years as it was. It was the humor that broadened it out and ended up at Tribeca Film Festival, all those things. And I hear that all the time from people. They just thank me for taking this dry subject and making it a little broader and kind of more enjoyable.
Randy Olson, scientist, filmmaker, and author of the book Don't Be Such a Scientist. He's coming to Salt Lake City tomorrow night. More information on our website, kcpw.org. If you'd like to join us again, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. You mentioned part of your hypothesis, your thesis, whichever you want to go with, is that the messages are not getting through to the general public. But I have to say, there's more science programming than ever before. You've got the Discovery Channel, you've got Nova, you've got major motion pictures.
Wait.
Like Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth. I don't know if accessibility is an issue.
Well, this becomes a question of what kind of science, and quote science, is being conveyed. And there ain't much science on the Discovery Channel anymore. I'm sorry. Once upon a time there was, but they found out that there are all kinds of people that like shows about logging and crabbing and things like that. And there just isn't very much there anymore. And unfortunately, you know, one of my friends here in Hollywood's a producer on those types of shows. And he told me that lately the words science and scientists are perceived as, quote, elitist. And that is an attitude that's been propagated. And so there's not as much programming. Furthermore, if you take a look at like print journalism, science journalists have been laid off all across the country in the written media everywhere. It's a major trend. And we see it in just the science literacy in this country. We're down to like 27th or something in the world for, you know, high school science literacy. It's a pretty well-established pattern that we've got going there. I don't think it's the end of the world if the general public's not that science literate. But what I feel is far more important is simply that the science community figures out the ways in which to get their argument across to the public, particularly in something like this climate change stuff, where the science community is very certain at this point that we've got major problems on the way and in progress, and yet they're unable to really get it across in a compelling manner. So the public's just still sitting out there kind of shrugging their shoulders saying, I'm not buying it.
Mm. Critics of your work would say that you go too far the other way, that you are dumbing down science. I'd like to hear your response on that.
not in the least, no. And that's, again, that's like the story phobia. That's their own insecurity coming to bear. It's not about dumbing down, it's about story structure. And they don't understand what story structure is about if that's what their criticism is. As much as I'm trying to argue is there needs to be an improvement and a more valuing of the way in which information is conveyed, that scientists, whether they want to talk about it in public or not, engage in this every single day of their lives in storytelling. There was a Nobel laureate, P.B. Medawar, in the 1960s, who one of his last papers was called The Scientific Paper is a Fraud. And what he talked about was the fact that no matter how honest you are as a scientist, when it comes down to write your paper, you have to rearrange the facts. You have to delete certain things that you did. You have to move the chronology of how things went because you have to present it in a manner that the reader can follow and stay interested in it. That is storytelling. They just need to bring it out into the open and speak honestly about it and understand that in an information-saturated world as we have today, it is more important than ever before, and the science world is vastly behind the times on all of this, and that's all I can do is just keep telling them that. I'm sorry, you're stuck in the Pleistocene mud with your thinking about your connection with the public, and it's got to change.
Randy Olson, he is an award-winning filmmaker, author, scientist, and he's coming to Salt Lake City tomorrow night as part of the Nature of Things lecture series. If you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go back to the phones. Cornelli calling from Salt Lake City. Cornelli, hi.
Hi, Hi, this is Patrice Cornelie. I'm with the biology department at the university. I take exception to all the descriptions of us as dry and Pleistocene and all that. I find biology extremely exciting, and I kind of agreed with the earlier caller. I realize that doesn't address the issue of talking to the public, the fact that the evolutionary biology that I do, I find extraordinarily interesting and not dry in any way whatsoever, to the extent that many of us are unable to talk to the public in an exciting way. I think that is only because we're members of the human race. And there are so many exceptions to that rule right in our own department. For example, John Seeger, who I challenge anybody to be bored by talking to him, regardless of their level of education. And there are a number of others, of course. And you've actually mentioned on the show a number of brilliant scientists, not to mention Medawar, for example. So I just feel like you could give us a break. And that's all.
Sorry.
No
breaks today.
Don't make us sound like we're doing boring things all day. We're doing fabulous things. I should also point out that I'm also an artist. So, and I find that being an artist to be very similar to being a biologist, so it's not at all dry. Terribly exciting, terribly creative.
Professor Cornelie, to Randy Olson's point, though, that part of the reason why there's a disconnect in the debate over climate change or over evolution is because scientists have not effectively communicated what the data shows.
There's so many of us that have. And since I'm on the radio and I'm nervous, I cannot think of the Elegant Universe guy on television, Carl Sagan, as you said, Peter Medawar, so many people, and the people who give the science lectures to the public at the university here are brilliant, and I've taught biology to non-biologists and have been able to really excite my classes, even though they don't have a particular a knowledge of biology. So my only objection is applying sort of a broad brush to all of us as not being able to communicate. Indeed, if we couldn't, I don't think we would have made the progress that we have in getting the evolution story out there to the extent we have, and winning some lawsuits and all of that, just based on that very skill that a lot of us have.
Okay, thank you very much for the call. Randy Olson, a broad brush. Is it unfair to paint everyone with that same brush that you have, that, you know, scientists in general are not good communicators?
Yeah, sorry about that. Both of these callers are very nice people, I can tell, but they just aren't the proper judges. You know, they are enmeshed in this world, they're ensconced in it, and they're very enthusiastic about the material. That's not enough. Good intentions count for nothing in the broader realm of communication. Just take the Al Gore movie, for example, An Inconvenient Truth. Many scientists feel that that was a wonderful piece of media. I'm sorry, the polls show it was not a wonderful piece of media. It did nothing to change the public's attitude towards climate change. And in fact, there's good reason to think that it actually kind of contributed to where we are today, which is the highest level of skepticism ever. I don't think these people understand the seriousness of what's going on here. The entire profession of climate science is under attack, and the science world has no idea how to defend itself because they don't understand communications. They got attacked in a major assault in 2009 with the ClimateGate incident, and they had no idea how to defend from that. I know this. I work with these sorts of people that are now trying to figure out ways to prepare for this in the future. And there's two different elements to the communication. There's acute and chronic. There's the acute part, which is knowing how to deal with a communications crisis like that, like image management, like you get with big-time public relations firms. But there's the chronic element as well, which is the ongoing public relations, positive public relations, to educate the public on all the good work that the science community does. And the perfect example is the climate science world. For starters, they've done unbelievable stuff with the phenomenon of El Nino. Here in the state of California, 12 years ago, Nobody knew what El Nino was. Today, everybody knows, and they structure their lives around it. That's all stuff that the climate science world has brought to you. But the profession of science doesn't know how to engage in any sort of public positive image building to get the public to understand this is, you should trust us as climate scientists. We've brought you all these good things. But if you don't get out there and actively do that, it's not going to happen. And that's what happens as a scientist. You just assume those things will happen. Well, everybody values scientists. No, they don't. Not anymore. There's a major anti-science movement in this country that has come together, and they're getting smarter by the day. And, you know, it's happening.
I want to squeeze in one more call before our time's up. This is Stephanie from Salt Lake City. Stephanie, hi.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
I'm somebody who's well-educated. I'm over 50. I'm just starting to learn about science in a way that's exciting to me. I have the tapes from Professor Hazen at George Mason University, The Joy of Science, but I see in that exactly what this author is talking about. My problem has always been that scientists communicate in a language that is their own. They do not use metaphors very often to explain a word like mass, you know, a word like volume, density. How is that different from weight? I'm just learning these things now. I feel like as a child going through school, it was just a language I did not understand. People who got it, and they went that direction. And people like me waited until I was 50. I went the other direction. I went into language, and I went into law. I'm a very creative person, and those words I did not understand. And when they define them with another scientific word. They don't say mass is like a bag of marshmallows, that if you press it down, the mass is the same, but the shape of it, the weight doesn't change, the volume is the same. I don't know how to describe this, but for me, that's what it was. And when you talk about communication, to me, it's language. It's the words. It's never being able to speak the same language, because some of us do not define the word with another word that we don't understand. That make sense?
Yes. Thank you very much for that thought.
Yay.
Stephanie seems to understand the message that you are trying to get across. The scientists that have called in today, not so much.
And This is great.
Well, I'm just wondering, I mean, how are you going to convince people in the scientific community that this is a legitimate problem, that they need to take it seriously, that that sex sells, you know? how can you get over that hurdle?
Well, this is wonderful. Let's look at the scoreboard. We've got two calls against me, both from scientists, and one call that's pro, which is a non-science person. And that's what I was saying, you know, your ability to judge these things is from your perspective. It's very difficult. I mean, if you just look, my book, what's interesting about my book is about my journey, and it begins with one paragraph of profanity from the opening night of my acting class when this acting teacher screamed her lungs out at me, and she said, "Nobody wants to watch you as an actor. You're too much caught up in your head. You're too cerebral. All you do is stand there and think. You need to come out of your head, and it's hard to get that to happen." And that was what she was saying. She's saying, I've broken your type before. I worked with a woman who was a psychiatrist, and I finally got her to be less cerebral, but she said it drained so much of my energy that I'm just sick of it. I don't even want to deal with you anymore, so get out of my class. It's very hard, and as I said, it took a solid 10 years for me thinking through all the things that were screamed at me. And in some ways, this is turning into the cycle of abuse because, you know, I'm sitting here saying all these mean things to the poor, nice science people, and I think I'm just propagating what she screamed at me. But I do realize that my cerebral orientation back then made it very hard for me to hear what she was saying. And all I could think that night as she was screaming at me was, "You're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong." And it took a long time for it to slowly penetrate in. That's what happens when you get so heavily cerebral, your ears shut down, you can no longer listen, and you become really bad at communication. And that's what goes on with the science folks.
Mm.
And sorry to paint with the broad brush. Sorry. but I am positive that scientists did evolve from humans and that the divide was relatively recent, and that is the subject of my talk tomorrow night.
Randy Olson, scientist, independent filmmaker, author of the book Don't Be Such a Scientist. He is delivering the lecture Storytelling, Clear Proof, Scientists Descended from Humans, tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the City Library here in Salt Lake City. Olson is the first speaker in the Natural History Museum of Utah's annual Nature of Things lecture series. The event is free and open to the public. You can hear it live here on KCPW. Randy Olson, thanks very much for your time today.
No, thank you, and thank you to the callers, and sorry if I offended you. That's just what I do.
Up next, a taste of Salt Lake City, courtesy of the Junior League. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. It's been 12 years since the Junior League of Salt Lake City published a cookbook, but a new edition has finally arrived. And joining me now to talk about the collaborative effort and how the recipes reflect changes in Utah cuisine over the years, Jennifer Kelsey. She is the current 2011-2012 president of the Junior League of Salt Lake City. She's been an active member since 1997, and Jennifer joins me in studio. Hi.
Hi, thank you.
And Heidi Makowski. She is past president of the league and is currently the director of the cookbook committee for the Junior League of Salt Lake. And Heidi's joining me in studio as well. Heidi, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. How has your cooking changed over the past decade? And what's your favorite Junior League recipe? 801-355-8255, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Before we get to the recipes, tell us a little bit about your group, the Junior League. What is your mission, Jennifer Kelsey?
So we are a women's organization internationally. There are over 500 junior leagues, and we work within our communities to work with women and children and to promote trained volunteers for women. So we like to really prepare our volunteers to be able to learn new skills that will hopefully help them in their careers or in their lives outside the league. And we're also able to help different community organizations in our direct community.
You have been championing health, cultural, educational skills and opportunities, causes for 80 years. So why publish a collection of recipes?
Well, long ago, we found that different cookbooks across the country were helping to raise funds so that we can champion these causes in our area. We currently have different projects such as our Care Fair, our Women Helping Women Boutique, our EPIC program that we partner with the Salt Lake CAP Head Start, and also our Kids in the Kitchen, where we are trying to help fight childhood obesity. And the proceeds from these cookbooks allow us to fund those programs. And also then our volunteers, of course, provide volunteer hours to assist with that.
Heidi Makowski, the Junior League has published four cookbooks over the years, Heritage, A Pinch of Salt Lake, Always in Season, and now Salt to Honey. What really sets this new book apart from the other volumes that you've published?
Well, if you look back at every cookbook that we've done, it reflects how people are cooking at that time and in that decade. And this book relates to how we're cooking now. It's lighter, more fresh ingredients, different ingredients than we've had in past cookbooks. And when we were creating this concept, we wanted to find the newest trends in cooking and eating, and that's really the local food movement. Mm. So this book reflects that unlike any others in the past, and it really draws attention to the wonderful food companies, purveyors, growers that we have in our community that really provide something very unique and wonderful and delicious, and many of those companies are included in the book. So several different ways it just reflects how we're cooking today, which is different than how we've done the past 12 years ago when our last cookbook was published.
Would we recognize any of the recipes from past editions in this cookbook, or have our tastes changed just fundamentally?
Well, I think they have changed, but it's still very personal. I mean, people like to cook in certain ways, but I think our tastes have changed, and that's reflected in the kinds of recipes that we did get submitted to us. And we have paid homage to our past cookbooks. We have included a few vintage recipes that were real favorites of our committee, and they're denoted in the cookbook with a little honey stick. Mm-hmm. So you'll see a couple of the favorites. But we do have new recipes, and they are original.
Heidi Makowski, she is the Cookbook Committee Director for the Junior League of Salt Lake City. Also with us, Jennifer Kelsey, President of the Junior League. And we're talking about their latest cookbook called Salt to Honey, Recipes for Great Gatherings. They have a launch party tomorrow night. We'll tell you about that in as we go. But if you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number. If you've got a favorite Junior League recipe, you can feel free to share your stories. 801-355-8255. Heidi, you mentioned that you had lots of recipes coming. You solicited recipes from your members. You got a huge response, over 1,000 recipes. How did you finally decide which ones to include?
Well, after we got 1,000 recipes over a few months, we spent a lot of time evaluating them. We needed to make sure that they matched the theme of the book and reflected the kinds of cooking that we wanted to include in the book, and we needed to make sure that they were original.
How about taste testing? I bet that was a hard part of the job.
It was very hard. After we evaluated, then we started testing, and we had our committee did a tremendous amount of the testing. We had a few people from the community, but we tested the recipes and brought a lot of them to our meetings, and sometimes we would have 20 or 30 dishes we were taking a taste of, and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I bet.
But we did really evaluate to see what we liked, and we felt like we have a good idea of what the community would like within our committee, and if they passed our various tastings, then they were included.
Mm-hmm. Jennifer, were you part of that taste testing adventure?
I did have the opportunity, and my waistline shows it. We also had the opportunity to bring some of them to our general membership meetings, and mm-hmm. where we would do ballots and have the entire membership do some tasting for us as well. It's a fun opportunity.
A lot of fun.
As I thumbed through the collection, okay, cheese, hominy, grits, sweet and nutty quinoa, stir-fried bok choy, and shiitake mushrooms. Are these recipes distinctly Utahn in any way? Because it does seem to have quite an international flair.
Well, I think the ones you've picked out really show how we're cooking. And people like the new ingredients. You know, quinoa is something that most people haven't heard of until just very recently, but it's delicious and very easy to prepare. And while we are in a landlocked state, we have a lot of seafood recipes. We love our seafood, and we like to be, our cooks like to experiment. I will say, though, this book is very much designed for the home cook. Even though some of the titles you read sound a little, they're interesting and might put some people off with the ingredients if they're not familiar. The book is designed for the home cook. It's not for a chef. Anyone can really buy that, follow the instructions, which are very easily written, and have great success. That's where the testing comes in. We make sure that we can find the ingredients, make it, and it will turn out. So you can be very comfortable when you buy the book that you're going to have success when you cook from it.
Well, Utah certainly has a proud tradition in Jell-O. I don't see a lot of Jell-O recipes.
There
are
none.
I mean, are we just changing? In many ways, this recipe, this cookbook is changing the perceptions of who we are.
Yes.
And what we eat.
Yes, it is. It is, and there are no Jell-O recipes. And we like Jell-O, many people do, but we really don't need another Jell-O recipe. We want
but
to
do,
take...
do we not eat Jell-O as much? Is that what you're saying?
My committee doesn't. I don't think my committee eats Jell-O. I don't.
We didn't have. I don't think there were very many, if any, submitted. So I believe that's, you know, the things that were submitted by the community, and people show what it is that we are eating more of.
Right. You won't find that a casserole or your typical pot roast, but we have, as I said, a lot of seafood and brisket and other kinds of, lots of salmon and shrimp and chicken and pasta and wonderful soups and salads that a lot of people are using for entrees.
This edition also includes some submissions from local farmers and food artisans here. I recognize, you know, Lehigh Roller Mills and Morgan Valley
Lamb.
And so why was this important to you to include those local sources of food?
We really wanted to include the community because we're so proud of what we have to offer in our state, and they make products that we really enjoy and like to eat. We have several lamb recipes, and in fact, we did have a signature recipe created just for this book, and that does actually use lamb. And then we wanted to kind of pay tribute to the salt to honey, which our state's really well known for. And it just makes our book really stand out and be unique and take advantage of what we have in our own backyard for delicious eating.
What was the best part of this project for you, Heidi?
That's really hard to say. It really was the experience of a lifetime for me personally, and I think for my entire committee. I have a group of women who I just love and respect. We worked really hard and are so proud of the final product. I think working together and creating something so beautiful and wonderful out of nothing is something that, you know, we will always have a memory of, and we had a wonderful time, and we're so proud of the finished product and can hardly wait for people to start buying it.
Jennifer Kelsey, briefly.
Well, something that I wanted to add is I've really watched everybody. It is a business. It's a small business. They have had to learn to market, edit, write, edit. But I mean, there has just been an incredible amount of business learning that has gone through this two-year experience, much more than just bringing in recipes and turning them in. It has really been amazing.
Jennifer Kelsey, Heidi Makowski with the Junior League of Salt Lake City. They have a launch party for their new cookbook, Salt to Honey, Recipes for Great Gatherings, tomorrow night. More information on our website, kcpw.org. Jennifer and Heidi, thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake City. Thanks to Tamara Kemsley and Katie Sheen Abbott. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Next time, a conversation with the filmmaker Bill Carrig and former Salt Lake City Mayor Didi Corradini on the struggle to include women's ski jumping in the Olympics. You can join us for that tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.